You are listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. Join him as he and his guests discover how businesses thrive in California.
Well, welcome to The Pilgrim on the 405. We're going to be talking today about businesses and how they get their systems together, how they get data from those systems, how they look forward to what's happening because they can predict carefully and accurately because they have systems and data that they can depend upon. And to help us with that, we have Alan McGuire, one of the fine B2B CFO folks who come in and help companies who aren't at the size where they need a full-time CFO, but are wise enough to know that they do need piece of a CFO. And so, welcome to the Pilgrim on the 405, Alan.
Thank you, Will.
So, Alan, tell us a little bit about B2B CFO and what is it that companies can look for from this part-time CFO?
At B2B CFO, we try to help small and medium-sized companies from 5 to 75 million who don't need a full-time CFO, or better still, shouldn't be paying for a full-time CFO. Perhaps they should be focusing that dollars, that money on marketing, development, new products, etc. We end up coming in on a part-time basis as need be and helping them develop new systems, improve their existing systems, make better decisions, and hopefully at the end of the day, increase profit. To differentiate a CFO from a controller or accountant, and a controller or accountant generally are good people and they're needed, but they're generally keeping score, as in looking in the rearview mirror. A full-time CFO or even a part-time CFO should be trying to help the business, looking out the front window of the automobile.
So if I understand this, what a part-time CFO or any CFO can do is take over responsibility for lots of the direction of the company in terms of the finances and data production and things of that sort.
We end up being a partner with the business owner or the CEO in deciding how and where to go going forward. We almost always start off with quality of financial statements. That matters to the business owner, that matters to the bank, that matters to investors. But the benefit besides that is at the same time you end up with better information to make decisions.
Well, so how did you become one of the B2B CFOs?
I have been a CFO for 27 years in small and medium-sized businesses. Before that, I was a controller and all the other accounting jobs. I had my own CFO business for about 10 years. Went and took another full-time job, which was wonderful and interesting, and came out the other side of that and decided once again I wanted to be a CFO on a temporary or fractional basis. I love the impact it makes on small businesses. I love helping entrepreneurs. The added benefit for business owners and entrepreneurs, as well as helping them build their business and get more profitable, is quite frankly part of what I do for a living. Is I reduce stress. Just taking that burden off the business owner, helping them share the load, and share the vision and helping them develop that vision.
Well, that's wonderful. Tell us a little bit about what kind of stress a business owner might be feeling. What sort of signs that he doesn't have everybody on board that he needs to have on board?
Business owners generally get into business or take over second generation or third generation business because they're good at something. They could be a good salesperson, a good entrepreneur, a good engineer. They generally aren't good at everything. Great CEOs, business owners are ones that realize and play their strengths and help supplement their weaknesses. Often there's some issue in the business where it's very obvious they are, for good reasons or bad reasons, have cash strains. It's just one example. Businesses that are doing really well, that are growing very quickly and have good margins, often get into cash strains. And that's a somewhat of a mechanical and somewhat of an art form in terms of knowing how to balance that as businesses grow. Often good businesses with good products, perhaps they're equipment intensive. They're buying equipment with short-term assets, and maybe they should be buying equipment with long-term assets that match the benefit coming from that equipment. a client that buys a couple $100,000 piece of equipment and then will make the product from that for a contract over 2 or 3 years, really should be matching the benefit of that piece of equipment with the cost of that equipment. And it's not something that a business owner or entrepreneur happens to think about on a daily basis.
So in a real sense, the CFO is bringing in a particular set of skills to the business that wouldn't have been there otherwise.
Generally, correct. Totally.
And most businesses are started by founders, or a CEO comes on board, and they're focused on producing a product or providing a service. And without a plan, then the business doesn't just come together, does it?
Generally, I think it was Jack Welch. Let me back up a bit. I think it was Jack Welch that said, I think you need 3 things to run a successful business. 1 is a good product. 2 is a good sales team. And 3 is a financial partner. It doesn't make an entrepreneur weak or anything else. It's just getting all the pieces in a row. A entrepreneur in a business environment that doesn't know anything about manufacturing may be the best engineer in the world, maybe the best salesperson in the world, and he has the intelligence to go out and hire a good manufacturing person or a good manufacturing technical person. Hiring a good CFO with 10 or 20 years experience is very much very similar to that.
All right, so what we talk about in Traction, Gino Wickman talks about in the Traction book, is that businesses do need sales and marketing. They're organized along their production and then the finance. And now, it seems to me that's a shift from, or maybe it's a transition point where businesses grow to the place where they are actually going to begin segmenting the responsibilities and finding people who are competent in each of those areas.
Depending upon the complexity of a business, at some point most businesses need a full-time CFO. Sometimes that's $75 million. Sometimes it's $100 million if it's a simple business. But at 4 or 5 or 10, unless you have unique needs, you don't necessarily need that full-time CFO. In my case, in many of the B2B CFO partners' case, we have 10 or 20 years experience or more. And so we've been down that road, had that experience, made that mistake. Somebody else has paid us to make the mistake, and we're not about to do it again. And so you take that learning experience and you apply it to the current situation and help that business owner.
Well, how does a business owner know that he needs to pick up the phone and call you?
It's almost always caused by or triggered by either an event or a need. A trusted advisor will come in and say, hey, maybe you should talk to these people. A banker will tell them that they need to get their financial statements in order. They're feeling stressed from a cash point of view. Very common for a business owner to say, hey, I can't get my hands around this business anymore. They feel like they're working buried in the business as opposed to working on the business. There's all those feelings about going to work every day, working 12 hours, and feeling like you didn't accomplish anything because what you started in that business to accomplish, you're no longer doing. You're doing the administration. You're dealing with all the employee issues all day and not going out and doing what you plan to do and what you love to do for a living.
Well, in the organization of a business, what does the CFO manage? I mean, does obviously manages money. And reporting, does he manage HR?
There's a wide variety of what they do. It can be accounting, finance, relationships with the bank. Very commonly, and I've done this a lot of times, HR, IT. I've managed customer service. In my mind, for those who aren't dealing with the customers, you should be dealing with somebody else who is dealing with that person who's dealing with the customers. It's all, in my mind, customer service in one form or another. So it's a pretty uniform vision of how you deal with that person or those people. It's not necessarily unique to being in accounting or being in IT. You should be serving those that are your customer.
Well, now, as a CFO, when you come in, do you bring relationships with banks with you that you can help the CEO?
I've been in Orange County for 22, 23 years. So depending upon the nature of the business and the size of the business, I have a number of very good relationships with banks in Orange County that I've dealt with for years in multiple situations. So I will try to tailor that banker, that lawyer, that HR solution, the IT solution to the need.
So give me some stories about when you have come into a company.
I've had a number of them. One reasonably simple one, a couple of years ago, dealt with a company that was feeling stress from the cash point of view. They had been in business for more than 20 years, and they were doing approximately $40 million a year, so $500,000 or $600,000 a week. They had, as I said, they had a cash stress issue. They were tight on cash. And we came in and looked at the financials and looked at the detail and looked at the financials and looked at the detail and kind of went, this doesn't make sense. The two of them didn't line up. And as it turned out, they had been, and they were selling services, they had been invoicing their customers about 30 days after they incurred the cost themselves. They've been doing that for 30 years. And a little bit of hard work and a little bit of change in some processes, we had them invoice a week later. They were selling and reselling services, so we had to get through payroll. And doing $600,000 a week, what ended up happening is we ended up picking up 3 or 4 weeks of receivables, which turned into cash, which dropped about $2 million in their bank account on a permanent basis, as long as they kept that up. And that solved the problem. The underlying cause why they had gotten into that were a couple losses, a couple investments, significant investment in a new IT system, all which caused stress. But it was reasonably easily solved by looking at what the financial statements were telling us.
And the CEO wasn't aware of that.
It had been done that way for 30 years, and he was not aware of it.
So a big question is, why are we doing this?
Exactly what we asked, why are we doing this? And the answer I, of course, got was, that's the way we've always done it. So we changed the way we've always done it.
Uh-huh.
It's very, very common for a business to, for example, another example here is to go out and purchase a piece of equipment, I think I said earlier, that pays back over multiple years of processing that order for which that piece of equipment is used. But you're paying for it all up front. If it's a good, solid piece of equipment, that's easy to finance. Banks love to finance them. Financing companies love to finance them. Money's cheap these days. And the right thing to do, quite frankly, is to match the return you're getting on that with the cost of that. I am in the process of doing that right now with the business.
Well, I've sometimes found companies that invest in major capital equipment then need to generate sales. They need to push up sales in order to, not to justify it, because they've already justified it, but in order to make the payments on that.
There's a process that I try to go through, an evaluation process, and then we go through just about every time. In the one that I'm thinking about, they happen to have a multi-year purchase order from a Tier 1 company. So it's a very simple process. It's just a matter of matching the cash in with the cash out. That happens to relieve a bit of stress that they would otherwise cause by purchasing that piece of equipment with cash up front.
So in a real sense, a thriving company really needs to get input from a variety of leaders in the business before they go out and make a capital investment like this.
Absolutely.
So another story.
Another story. Great manufacturing company, multiple plants, the last recession hit. And recessions are good to one extent in that they generally cause us to get a lot more efficient. We tore apart that business in the recession. I joined a couple of years before the recession. We found that they had a couple of customers that every time they took an order from that customer, they were losing money. The customer would say, I want 10,000 feet of item X, but I only want to take 100 feet now or 200 feet now. So they'd order 10,000 feet, they'd warehouse an inventory 10,000 feet, and then they get a draw for 100 feet. So they basically were putting dollars and cents on the shelf, not getting paid for them, and then selling them to that customer a dribble at a time. So what we did is we, quite frankly, told the customer they needed to take their inventory for which they'd ordered, told them if they want the lower price of the 10,000 foot run price as opposed to the 100 foot run price, that they need to take it or pay for it, or we'd be more than happy to sell it to them at the 100 foot price, which was much more than the 10,000 foot price. They hummed and they hawed and they pushed back a little bit. They ended up taking it. Going forward, we suggested that we'd sell it to them at the 100 foot price, and they didn't like that. They went out to other competition. And our 100-foot price was four times the price of the 10,000-foot price, and they ended up coming back and buying it at that price. Because, obviously, no one else was willing to sell it to them at that price either. At the end of the day, sales went down by about $4 million, and profit went up by $4 million, and we had $2 million worth of inventory that we turned into cash.
And chances are the salespeople were delighted and excited when they had that big sale. And they never had to figure out that it was only coming out in those 100-foot dribbles.
Yeah, to your point, not only were we inventorying it, but we were also paying commission on something that was sitting on the shelves.
Yeah, and so having a place where sales and marketing, finance, maybe HR, and the production people can sit with a real integrator who's going to be able to help those people work together harmoniously to get to the goals. That's an important piece of a growth of a company.
I think that in all or almost all cases, it's a team sport, a team effort, and a CFO or a B2B CFO is a member of the team.
Well, tell me about the difference between what I've often heard called the owner-centric company, where the owner or maybe one or two other people really have whatever vision there is for the company. They have the direction for the company themselves, and everyone else is simply taking, following instructions. And what's the difference between that kind of company and a company that's going to move forward?
That type of company often works in a smaller company. As you get bigger and bigger, it's harder for that business owner to make every decision, to make every little choice in the vision. So you end up having to get the right people in and trust those people doing various things. It gets very, very difficult at a $10 million or a $15 million business to have the vision and make every decision. I've seen lots of small and medium-sized businesses and business owners where that owner is making every decision. And then he ends up, as I said earlier, being buried in the business. He's not sharing the vision. He's not articulating it. So he's doing all the lifting himself.
And eventually that takes a toll on him personally, emotionally,
physically,
and maybe even financially.
Right.
Because he's not... He really doesn't have the quality of eyesight or the experience of the to see what's actually going on in the company.
Absolutely, by any means, either management span of control, expertise in everything. Depending on how you look at it, it gets very, very, very difficult, if not impossible, for that business owner to do everything, know everything in that business, and he eventually needs to get to the point where he trusts and leans on those various team members.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, is about the trust. How does that CEO who has historically run the business and attracted people to him who will do what he tells them to do, how does he build trust with people like yourselves? So I'm imagining having a team where the sales team is run by a very competent sales manager, sales VP. The production is done by a general manager who knows what they're doing. And likewise, having a CFO, even a part-time CFO. Where does that trust building come in?
We almost get referred by what is commonly referred to as a trusted advisor. It could be their CPA, it could be their lawyer, it could be somebody that they know. And then you end up earning that trust, and continually earning that trust. And as you work together and work together longer, you get more in sync every day. I've had business owners that for years before I got there never really had that relationship with a CFO, fractional or otherwise. And I end up having that relationship and working with that business owner for 6 or 7 years. We got to the point where we're almost finishing each other's sentences sometimes. But you know when you get there, I work for that business owner, CEO, but at the same time, he or she asks for advice and sometimes asks for guidance. I had one business owner, great guy, great engineer, great manager, but always wanted to invest in everything at the same time. And we just had to get to this cadence where he knew that if we could have a discussion and a decision about which one came first, if we do A, maybe A will pay for B, C, D, and E, and then we do B and C, and it would pay for them, and so on and so forth, and it could allow us to get more efficient in that manufacturing environment.
Well, that's great. That's great. And if you stick around a little bit, we'll come back and pick up on this whole process of bringing on board competent people who can be trusted. And so now, we've been talking with Alan McGuire, B2B CFO in Orange County. We're going to take a break, and we'll come right back to more on the Pilgrim on the 405.
Does your company need more than basic financial transactions? Are you holding your business back with your entry-level accounting software? When your business starts to grow, and it will, you'll need more security, features, and functionality. Well, let me introduce you to Gravity Software. Gravity Software's online accounting solution is written on the Microsoft CRM platform. No more islands of information. Financials and CRM are fully integrated and in the cloud. Gravity's goal is to fill the gap between entry-level accounting software like QuickBooks and complex and expensive enterprise applications. Gravity Software, simply innovative business management. Learn more at go-gravity.com.
Hi, it's time for another tip from Sandler Training. Never ask for the order. Make the prospect give up. Always ask for the order is the salesperson's 11th commandment. You know, the one that just dropped right off the tablets. Never ask for the order goes completely against traditional selling methods. If you don't ask for the order, how will you ever know when the customer is going to buy? Well, think about it. The only person who can really ask for the order is the prospect. Find the prospect's emotional needs first, provide the answers to meet these needs, and you'll discover that the prospect will give up and ask you for the order. And that's another tip from Sandler Training, finding power through reinforcement.
Well, welcome back to the Pilgrim on the 405, where we've been talking with Alan McGuire, one of the great B2B CFOs here in Orange County, who's had lots of experience in helping businesses move from being small businesses, oftentimes run in an owner-centric fashion, to companies that are thriving and ready to grow because they now have a collaborative way of working together to achieve their company vision. So we were talking before the break, Alan, we were talking about this process of building trust. Now, I'm assuming that when you come in, that's not just a relationship that you're going to have with the CFO alone. This extends to other people as they begin to make that change, doesn't it?
Absolutely. In a number of the businesses that I've worked in, I've been CFO, fractional or otherwise, but you end up almost being a combination of CFO and COO. For me, the instances where I get the absolute delight is not only changing the reporting and changing the information and the decision making, but if you can actually get in and kind of change the mindset of the company so they're all rowing in the same direction outside of my areas of responsibility, to me that's the be all and the end all.
So tell me a little bit more about this process of rowing in the same direction.
I think probably the easiest way is to give an example. I joined one company and then was helping them out. Had a number of different issues in that company. They had an on-time order rate, defined as within 48 hours, of about 75%. Over time, by working together with operations and credit and order customer service, at that time reported to me, it took about 2 years, we managed to get that up to between 96 and 98% of all orders on time delivery. And the interesting thing about that, above me on the mechanics and the system and making those changes, and in some cases even doing things like simplifying the pricing, it caused a bottleneck in shipping. I happened to grow up, and one of the things I did many, many years ago, I worked in the shipping department. So I did what I do, and I went out and helped in shipping. And there were a couple of people that were smart enough to realize what the CFO was doing. He was helping in shipping, and they came out and helped in shipping. My point was that it wasn't a shipping problem. It was a company problem, and we needed to solve the problem. And eventually got to the point where I had to kick people out of shipping because too many people were helping or didn't know what they were doing. But the real big point in that whole exercise was to change the mindset. And eventually it became a scheduled item where different people from different departments would come in on a Friday or Tuesday and work in shipping. Not because they needed to learn how to do shipping and packing and UPS, but we changed the mindset. I love that. When you can do that to a business and you can get people rowing in the right direction, it's not about me and my department or my area, it's about us. Then quite frankly, all you need to do is get out of the way.
Well, talk a little bit more about the mindset, where it is and where it goes.
I think you have to understand there's a whole bunch of different factors going on in any business. There's a formal organization structure, an informal organization structure. You need to know who's doing what and how to move that, who's rowing in the right direction, who's rowing in the wrong direction, who's pushing against you. And you eventually, with the right standards and the right information and the right measurements, one of the sayings that I like is you have to inspect what you expect. If you have people targeting to do something, ship X number of items, take X number of orders, produce financial statements in 5 days, you have to track that. You have to know what you're doing, therefore you have to have information to do that. If you get all that, put it all together, put it up where people who are being measured can see the measurements and object if they're wrong and correct them if they're right or whatever the case may be, then you end up with literally just having to get out of the way because people will generally do the right thing. And you make a difference.
Well, now, as you change this mindset, how does that affect the leaders in a particular area? Do they begin to take on more responsibility, to be held accountable in a way that they hadn't been being held accountable before?
At the same time that you do that, for if you want to use the shipping example or any other example, you have to give the leaders, the managers, the directors enough accountability and responsibility to make those decisions. You have to nudge them and guide them sometimes. I don't have all the answers. They generally have all the answers if they're asked. Often they've worked in an environment where they weren't asked and they weren't allowed to answer. So if you have the right people in place, you literally just need to empower them, measure them correctly, give them an input, and 9 times out of 10, they will exceed your expectations.
Exceed your expectations. I think that's certainly been my experience in working with companies, is that always exceeding expectations. And now, as they do that, they grow in terms of ability, responsibility, apparently self-esteem, see a different role that they play in the company, and another consequence of that is that business owner that we talked about who was so overburdened, it now begins to see some
that it actually
space.
does work.
It actually, he has a company.
Right. He's not. I have met business owners that literally have a lineup out their door, and they're making one decision, and often it's the same decision that they made yesterday. Somebody comes and they say, what should I do? Should I do A? And they say, yes, do A. And the next day they ask them the same thing and the same thing. I have one particular customer where the owner got sick for a couple of weeks. And he came back, and people that had been lining up outside his door every day asking him the same question, all of a sudden they were making the decisions. And they knew the answer. It was risk management to them. That's why they were asking the question. And they just, you know, it was their theory was it was better to beg forgiveness than ask permission, and there was no one there to ask permission of. And they went and they did the right thing. So sometimes it's a comfort zone for those people. Sometimes they don't know how to make a decision. Sometimes they don't think they have authority or responsibility or accountability. It takes a lot of effort. It doesn't happen because you happen to set up a shipping department. It happens because you happen to set the guidelines for the people and the measurements for the people, and it works.
And the owner doesn't allow those problems to come in and get on his desk.
Right.
He puts them back on people, and it seems to me that if the people really can't handle those decisions, they may be in the wrong place.
There may be a better right place for them.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. And so there it seems to me that while the transition from that owner-centric business to one that's more equipped to grow and to make full use of the productivity and the creativity of the employees and especially the leadership, while that's a simple thing to do, the reasons that it was not done are very complex and multivariate. Could be ego. I want to control it because this is who I am. It could be I don't trust those people around me. It could be I really don't want to grow. All of those things and more come into play. How do you deal with all of that?
It could be they've had a bad experience in the past and it didn't work out and cost them a lot of money. One of the advantages of I'm not trying to sell me as much, but one of the advantages of somebody with lots of experience is, again, you've had the luxury, you made those mistakes. And some of it is you have to explain to people that you've made those mistakes before. It's not a CFO thing. It's not a B2B CFO thing. You get to your point, Will, you have manufacturing people that have been in the manufacturing business for 10 or 20 years, and they go, well, here's the answer, and this is how we do it, and I've done it 9 times, and they make it work. It's developing trust. Business owners got into that lifting by themselves problem, and they have to get out of it in a very similar way. They have to develop trust a lot of times.
Well, if they don't, the consequences are the company's going to hit the ceiling.
One way or the other, you can't do it all yourself.
Well, yes, and it'll either stay small, because that's the span of control that's comfortable, or even possible if the business owner wants to put everything he's got into it in terms of emotion and time. But there's going to be a limit to how big it can grow.
And businesses that eventually want to expand or sell or transition their business can't do so if it's attached to that one owner. And every decision is made by that one owner. So, literally, to your point, unless you want it to be an $X million business, if you want it to grow, you have to develop those skill sets. Sometimes that's a skill set of managing people.
Well, and what I've noticed is that there can be some significant emotional impacts on leaders who don't trust other people, who haven't put together a way to delegate decisions to competent people. I mean, they can wind up doing all sorts of strange things because they're just emotionally depleted.
And they're exhausted at the end of the day, and they can't take a day off, and their vacation means that they're on the phone all the time. Families suffer sometimes, any number of things.
Right, right. And the consequences of those are not very favorable.
It's interesting for me, when I walk into a business, you can literally see the shoulders of a business owner drop, and as he relaxes a little bit, and you start walking down that road. Again, it's I've seen great manufacturing people walk in and have the same effect in terms of it's sharing the load is what it is by any measurement. It's sharing the trust, and it's fantastic to see in a business owner.
Well, I mean, I think that's an important learning for me, and I think I'm still in the process of learning it, is that you don't need to do it all by yourself.
That's a learning experience. They learned how to, they walked in with a strength, they walked in with a passion, 10 years before, 2 years before, whatever the case may be, and somehow that's evolved to them carrying the load on their shoulders. I had one business owner, and I asked him after working with him for 2 or 3 years, you know, what's the best thing and the worst thing about his business, and he had 155 employees at the same time, and he said, you worry about you and your family. I worry about me, my family, and 155 other families. And I never looked at it that way. But he literally, to him, it was a yoke that he had to pull. And he felt like he was pulling it himself. And to me, that was, I've been working at that point for 20, 25 years. And I had no idea that business owners thought about it that way.
Well, yeah, and that's a very important and good thing for business owners to believe, is that they do have a responsibility to employees, helping them to understand that they don't have to do it all themselves, but they can have that belief and then put structures into place which, when they're replicated throughout the company, will help everybody become much more self-reliant, much more productive, much more self-sustaining, and then be able to participate in the vision for the company.
It's a growing experience for a business owner who got into a business because of a certain skill set or passion to learn a new skill set. Sometimes that's management. Sometimes it's leadership. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's realizing you're not the best leader. And in any number of things. It's interesting to see them change and grow, and many, many, many of them realize that, hey, I'm a really good engineer. I've known lots of business owners that hire a good outside president to run their business because their passion is manufacturing, their passion is designing products, and they hit their ceiling, and they realize they hit their ceiling. A lot of them, I've worked for people that have ran a business for 10 or 20 years, that were one particular person I'm thinking of was a great engineer, and he was the company's best salesperson, although he couldn't be the only salesperson, but he ended up being A1 class CEO in terms of managing people and so on and so forth. And I think he enjoyed that learning experience, and the fact that he got really good at that, I think he enjoyed it immensely.
And that is a process.
Right. It's a journey. It's not a point in time.
Yeah, so let's talk just a little bit about this notion of a vision. Now, it seems to me that when we were talking a couple of days ago, it became clear to me anyway that any company has the vision of growth, but there's a point where something is going to happen. They're either going to be sold to a strategic buyer, or they're going to be sold to somebody else. They might be sold to or turned over to an heir in the family, or it might be turned into an ESOP, right?
Right.
And now, having that kind of vision means that what we're going to do is we are going to move in toward that vision. And that vision is not something that has to be accomplished just by the CEO or maybe two or three people at the top. That can be the entire company involved in moving toward that, right?
To your point, almost every business or every business is going to transition at some point. 70% of all businesses don't transition in an orderly fashion. They transition because they, quite frankly, cease to exist. Sometimes that's a professional entity, you know, a lawyer's office or something like that. But if you want to transition your business over time, you want to maximize the value of that business. I think in any case you want to maximize the value. But if you're going to sell your business to either a financial buyer or a strategic buyer, you want to maximize the value of the business. One of the worst things you can do is have it be just you. So one of the first thing any buyer is going to look at is, when you and I were talking, I said the first thing any buyer is going to look at, it, the first three things is management, management, and management. Because if it's not replicatable, if it's not duplicatable, then it's what's he got to buy? It's different if a big company buys a little one and just folds it in for product or folds it in for whatever. But generally, a 10 or 20 or $30 million manufacturing company that can't continue to exist after the owner is no longer involved is not worth nearly as much as something that can be duplicated and continued on and so on and so forth. So very much so.
Good. Well, and so getting really clear about what that vision is, when that is going to happen, what that's going to look like, and then how we're going to get there. I mean, those things to me are not something that one person unilaterally decides and hands down.
It's a huge multi-year process, generally. Most business owners that try to sell their business and try to hit the timing perfectly, it's very difficult to do that. So what you should do, and what I would encourage people to do, is embark on a process of making sure that your business is ready for that transition. That means putting processes in place. That means putting information in place. That means putting management in place, financial controls, financial reporting, comparing your business to other businesses out there. All that information is publicly available. At B2B CFO, we do that as part of the diagnostics, and we do it on an ongoing basis. But it's making sure all those things are in place. And then there's that whole process of exit strategy and trying to figure out how to do that. And that in itself is a multi-year process. I think for any business that wants to sell themselves, or the owner wants to sell a business, it's a 3 to 5 year process. It's not a point in time. It's a process. It's a journey. Any buyer is going to look at 3 years financials. And if you want to sell your business based upon good earnings, forward earnings, then you have to have at least 3 years of good growth and good or better than average EBITDA. And then you can start to think about those multiples and selling your business for the value. The saying I use is don't try to, the term is put lipstick on the pig. Don't try to put lipstick on the pig. Turn the pig into a racehorse first, and then stick lipstick on it. So in other words, grow that business from a $15 million to an $18 million or a $20 million business over 3 years. Get EBITDA from $800,000 to $1.5 million. You'll do two things. You will sell the business for a higher multiple because you've got years of success, and you will sell that multiple times a bigger number. So in terms of exiting, a business owner should focus on maximizing the value of his business. I certainly would. And that's, again, that's a process.
So tell us a little bit more about this discovery analysis that you just mentioned.
At B2B CFO, what we do is we sit down with the business owner when we are first introduced. We go through what we call a discovery analysis. It's complimentary. It's on my dime. And we interview the business owner, key members of management. We tear apart the financials to the extent they have it. We have proprietary software where we can compare that business in that market, in that state, for example, to its peers in that sales size, etc. Tell you how you're doing relative to your competitors, and we sit down and we work with those people to come up with a plan. We call it the game plan, and it's a process of the discovery analysis, and then coming up with a plan, and then executing that plan, refining that plan, and doing it all over again on a continual improvement process.
So it seems to me that it might make sense if we're looking at it helping the Orange County business community thrive, that it might be helpful to begin talking to, maybe continue talking to, people who are 4 or 5 years away from this exit, this transition, and help them to ask the questions that are going to help them to help put them and the company into a great position.
When people ask me, when should I be talking to the B2B CFO, my answer is as soon as possible, generally 3 to 5 years. I'm not going to be in there continually for 3 or 5 years. I think we need to go in and agree on the process, agree on the goals, agree on where the company is now, put the improvement process in place, focus on generating sales, mm-hmm. focus on what, if you're going to inspect what we expect, we have to define what we expect. Sometimes it means incentive plans in place for key management. Sometimes it means getting the right key management in place. And all those pieces need to get put in place. And it's a multi-year process. And as I said, strategic or financial buyer is going to want to look at 3 years financials, which means you need to get ahead of that by a year or two in optimal best case scenario to get 3 years of financials. And well, there's a thousand little pieces that you need to think of.
Well, if a business owner listening into our conversation said, I want to get in touch with Alan, how would he do that?
The easiest way is look at B2BCFO.com or Al McGuire, A-L-M-A-G-U-I-R-E at B2B.com. You can find us on Google. You can find us on our website. And the information is there to contact me.
Excellent. Well, Alan, this has been wonderful. If there was one thing that you could leave with business owners in Orange County, what would be the one thing that you would ask them to do?
Start early. Don't try to do it all yourself. Share the load. You will get much more out of it.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for being with us. I look forward to talking with you along the way many times. And this has been a wonderful conversation with Alan McGuire, one of the B2B CFOs in Orange County. You're doing such great work here to help companies thrive in California. And this has been the Pilgrim on the 405, encouraging you to help your business get in a position to thrive in California.
Been listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. To hear more of the programs in this podcast, go to www.willcrist.com.